This is Director Chris Rodriguez of the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness, and I want to welcome you to Season 2 of Intelligence Unclassified. This season, we are refocusing our episodes to better reflect NJOHSP's three core mission areas: counterterrorism, cybersecurity, and emergency preparedness. We'll be pulling both local and national experts in all these fields in an effort to discuss New Jersey's diverse threat landscape and to offer you a unique perspective on current homeland security trends and issues. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. Please feel free to add this podcast to your RSS feed or iTunes. You can also follow us on Twitter at NJOHSP and Facebook. All links can be found in the show notes and on our website, www.njhomelandsecurity.gov.
Hi, this is Dean Barada from the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness. In February of 2017, a few of us went down to the International Studies Association Conference in Baltimore, Maryland, to talk to academics and practitioners on the subject of terrorism, homeland security, and intelligence. The series of podcasts you're going to hear are our first thoughts and first observations based on listening to those presentations. My name is Dean Barada. I'm the Bureau Chief of the Analysis Bureau at New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness. And today I'm joined by Herbert Tinsley. Herbert is a researcher at the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism at the University of Maryland, or START. He earned his master's degree in Terrorism and Nonproliferation Studies from the Monterey Institute of International Studies, a bachelor's degree with honors in political science from the University of Pittsburgh, and a diploma with honors in Modern Standard Arabic from the Defense Language Institute. Tinsley's research interests include terrorism in the context of new religious movements, apocalyptic millenarianism. Can you please spell that?
Sure. Apocalyptic millenarianism.
Thank you.
Sure.
Fedayeen-style attacks and identity construction in the jihadist literature. So, Herbert, thank you very much for agreeing to talk to us today.
Entirely my pleasure.
And I'm sorry I butchered your field of research.
Not at all.
But we'll start off here. We said that one of your areas of attacks. Can you talk about what are those? What does that mean?
Sure. So immediately, Paris and Mumbai are the best exemplars of Fidian style or Fidian attacks. What we're talking about here are small cadre kinetic attacks. These are small groups of perhaps Islamist fighters who are penetrating an area which is nominally controlled by their adversary and attempting to potentially cause mass casualties, or focus on some other specific objective that has been pre-planned for the engagement. These are extremely dynamic attacks. They allow operational art, and by operational art, I essentially mean moving beyond the tactical level and attempting to weave tactics into a strategic outcome, so to speak. So Fidian attacks are more like campaigns in miniature. They contrast very distinctly from single event attacks. They are, from the layman's point of view, I would say difficult to anticipate in terms of how they might shape themselves, how they might be structured. One of the things I've been attempting to do over the last several months is provide a model for Fidian attacks, for an attack cycle, so to speak. And one of the things I'm going to do tomorrow at the ISA is to unveil for the first time this new I've come up with, as it were.
Excellent. Now, I first came upon the term shortly after the Iraq War started, and I'll talk about a force that Saddam Hussein had created called Fedayeen. Mm. Is there a connection between these two?
Sure, absolutely. So from the linguistic roots, we're talking about a verb which essentially means to sacrifice or to give something up in order to obtain something else, usually something more worthwhile, naturally. In this particular case, we're talking about the giving up of one's life for a jihadist purpose. So anyone who is expected to dare, quote-unquote, their life for the purpose of a greater cause. The Fedayeen of classic go back all the way to the 7th century, where we're discussing single Muslim warriors who would stand out from the fray and combat their Quraysh adversaries, usually against insuperable odds. That same ethos has been translated into the jihadist mainstream of today, where we're seeing individuals who, for the most part, are willing to, again, sacrifice their lives for the sake of perhaps simply annihilating as many infidels as possible, or, again, attempting to capture some particular objective that is strategically embedded within this dynamic attack style. But to answer your question more directly, the term has often been used as a direct equivalent to the English term commando. So the Saddam Hussein that you're thinking of, there are also a number of Palestinian units that were involved in commando-style raids against Israeli military facilities in the 1970s and otherwise. All of these have been called by that term. One of the reasons I use this term is because it closely to this underlying philosophical and religio-political ethos that I just described to you, the notion of not only being willing to sacrifice your life, but essentially orienting your own intentionality, as it were, to the higher purpose, the Sabil Allah, the path of God in jihad.
Okay. So would you classify, let's say, attack as a Fedayeen attack?
I would not. So one of the things I've been attempting to do with this model specifically is to show what exactly distinguishes these attacks from a single event terrorism. One of the most important aspects to capture is the fact that there's a dynamism within the very attack execution itself. So there's basically four different modes that take place. There's engagement itself, when an attacker group is actually directly attacking a population, a target. Then there's a pulsing movement, as it were, when there's a decision to disengage, rapidly move to a new target, or perhaps simply change tactics, as it were. A third is diversion. So there's a concerted attempt, perhaps by planting booby traps or creating an unwitting VBIED, which allows for the diversion of defender forces away from a potentially targeted area. And lastly, swarm, which we might consider as being the various components of the attack, then focusing on one area, all of the attackers consolidating in one place. The sophistication of these attacks seems to be delineated by the number of those dynamics that are displayed. So I would say that at least two or more such dynamics, say a engagement naturally, because after all, there has to be a direct engagement. An engagement and a pulsing movement would make it a Fedayeen attack. Or an engagement and a pulsing and then a diversionary movement would make it a Fedayeen attack. In the San Bernardino case, you have a single event, essentially. It's there was no attempt to divert. There was no attempt to then change tactics, so far as I am aware. Whereas Oslo, I have drawn that into the analytic modality that I want to focus on, specifically because whether we agree or not that it is indeed a Fedayeen attack, even based on my definition, at the very least it shows the single individual can indeed wreak if he attempts to apply what we might know as the Fedayeen model.
And the Oslo attack you're talking about is that by Anders Breivik in 2011, correct, where he detonated a bomb in Oslo, and then he went to another location and shot 77 people. And now,
forgive me, 69 on Toya Island, 8 were killed in the bombing.
And now there, Anders Breivik was motivated by Islamic ideology. So does that mean that's not a component of the Fedayeen definition as you're using it here?
Right, that's a good question. I think that if we want to be purist about this, then we should say, yes, Fedayeen can only be an Islamist phenomenon. However, in the case of Breivik, we see a number of aspects are very close to the way the jihadists themselves think about the Fedayeen attack. Jihadists look not only at these commando-style raids, but also at suicide bombings using the same term. Therefore, Breivik captured characteristics that the jihadis do, and he admitted a certain admiration for the jihadist tactical elan that was notable throughout the 2000s and elsewhere. He says so in his manifesto, for that matter. Whether or not the Breivik attack was indeed a Fedin or Fedin comparable situation, we at least have a situation where, or circumstance where, this attack model has become an ideological milieu that is completely separate and alien to Islamism, which in and of itself is a very troubling consideration.
Have you seen, riffing off of that a little bit, have you seen other ideologies have maybe seen these Fedayeen tactics become attracted to them or beyond Anders Breivik?
Beyond Breivik, no. Well, I should say this. Beyond ultra-nationalist movements within Europe, no. Mm-hmm. There was one other case in Poland seemed to be preparing an attack against the Polish parliament. You probably recall that. Whether or not that would have been a full-on Fedayeen attack or not is the question. He was stopped before it occurred. But no, outside of the ultra-nationalist movement within, there's been really no clear indications. That isn't to say, however, that I mean, terrorists are extremely innovative. They're constantly looking at the broader landscape to determine whether or not there are new attack modalities that they can adopt. Whether their ideologies allow for that sort of translation is another matter, but something that needs to be analyzed. But just by the various sources do, it's clear that someone has probably looked at this particular attack package and thought to themselves, I wonder if we can carry that out. Do we need the organizational backing? Can I do it like Breivik did, et cetera, et cetera?
So that being said, looking back at some of the attacks you talk about, Mumbai, Paris, Brussels, how difficult is it to put together cells like this to conduct a Fedayeen attack, deploy them, and sort of be reasonably successful?
Well, I would not include Brussels because it was a bombing attack. Mm-hmm. And again, there was no dynamics in the tactics. The question of how you put one of these attacks into operation is a complicated one. Each, at least of the three attacks that we've mentioned thus far, Oslo, Paris, and Mumbai, each of them had very distinct preparational profiles, so to speak. Islamic State, which seems to have had sight to create a number of apparati that would allow them to conduct such attacks in Europe, even as early as 2014, not conducting the attacks, but preparing for them, seems to have allowed them to create a compartmentalization whereby there are certain logistical pathways, certain operational pathways, certain informational pathways that have, due to the movements handlers in Syria, they've been able to sort of weave them together and allow for operations to emerge. Or there's the possibility that a single individual would simply take it upon themselves to spend years dedicated to an attack of this nature. Mumbai also shows some of the compartmentalization to the degree that Lashkar-e-Tayyiba may not have been the only organization involved. There may have been a strategic component itself in terms of trying to marshal some of the resources beyond LET to make the surveillance possible, to make, for instance, the notion of the attack itself to be available to the various groups that took interest in it. I don't want to get too much into the weeds here, but it's really interesting to note there are a number of South Asian journalists and investigators who believe that the original attack plan came from the inter-services intelligence of Pakistan, that there was no intention on the part of the, you know, mainline organization to develop this sort of attack, but there might have been, you know, rogue offices or front-line units, as it were, who basically made it available to Al-Qaeda and to other organizations, and they carried it forward from there.
How should we think about the frequency of these attacks in the West? Should we be concerned about their... how should we think about is...
Hit me into a corner with that.
Yeah, there you go. So I'm, you know, having Mumbai in 2008, Paris 2015, mm-hmm. Maybe Breivik in 2011, mm-hmm. Where should we put that in sort of our ranking of concerns?
I think we should be concerned. I don't necessarily think we should be concerned due to lack of frequency or well, to start that again, let me say that they have a greater geographical spread now, whereas these attacks, it appears, have been much more plausible within areas of greater political instability. Seeing these sorts of attacks take place in a location like Paris is very worrying. Regardless of the robustness of a law enforcement organization, police attempt terrorist use. When terrorists are capable of changing their tactics rapidly within the same operational parameters, that's much more difficult for police to handle. They're trying to look at their playbook and determine, okay, what's the run counter to this, as it were. That's not possible in a Fedayeen attack, for the most part. There's a need to be much more dynamic, much more aggressive, in order to cut them off early on. My concern, and there is a certain amount of philosophical change within police agencies where this is concerned. There's a lot of active shooter preparations these days, which to some degree will help police agencies deal with Fedayeen attacks. However, again, it's the mindset that these individuals are coming into the attack with, that they are, as it were, foisting combat within a non-combat civil peace situation. Police are meant to, as best as possible, protect the civil peace. They're not thinking like combat operators, as it were. If they were, however, then there's a possibility that, again, the operational art that the Fedayeen are using would become part and parcel with the response, and thus you might be able to see certain patterns. You might be able to get the jump on these attacks, even in their earliest phases. Intelligence, though, is it's, and we've made it our priority, at least in the West, to gain as much surveillance over the communications of jihadists as possible. But getting the specific and precise indicators down as to whether or not one of these sorts of attacks is going to take place is one of the reasons why I'm trying to forward the research.
So would it be fair to say that, let's say, during the Paris attacks, there was the hostage situation in the concert hall? Police began by treating it as a hostage negotiation, hostage rescue. Had they recognized this was a Fedayeen attack, they probably, am I correct in understanding you and saying, had they recognized this was a Fedayeen attack, the proper course of action would have probably been a much more aggressive response earlier?
And yet, let us also, the French police and the RAID agency itself that was involved in that situation, for taking aggressive measures when they did. When they realized, by way of a number of text messages out of the Bataclan, that people were being executed without any negotiation in place, they seized the opportunity to prevent further casualties. So yes, absolutely. If there is intelligence, actionable intelligence, which would lead a SWAT team or an HRT team to take that sort of action, then they should be allowed to take that action as quickly as possible. Mind you, there's definitely liabilities that are involved there. You have a much greater chance of causing civilian casualties if you do so. But nevertheless, not to sound cynical about this, but those casualties, for the most part, are a foregone conclusion if indeed a Fedayeen attack is in play.
So if we hear about a terrorist attack ongoing, mm-hmm. Are there indicators you think that would sort of tip the hand to authorities, like that this may be a Fedayeen attack, and that maybe this is just the first phase of, you know, what will the other four components that you mentioned are yet to come?
Potentially. I admit I'm still working on that particular issue. I think that, as with the analysis and study of what we might call single event terrorism, there's something to be said for considering the logistics phase. That might be veiled from the eyes of intelligence for the most part. There can be any penetration of how and what sort of materials are being gathered, what sort of weapons, whether bombs are also in the mix, as it were, and if there's a collection of implements ready and available for a dynamic style of operation, and there's a significant number of people that are being trained to do this or who are involved in this cell, then I think the question should be posed, is there the plausibility of a Fedayeen attack here and now? Whether or not it manifests that way or not may not be important for counterterrorist officials, because if you know that, you know, this particular cell has a lot of dynamic possibility just in what sort of logistical choices they've made, then I think it simply causes you to, you know, run the red flag up the pole even more so. There are no definitive indicators. If indeed such an attack goes forward and it's, you know, manifested, it becomes less of a matter of being able to prevent it, of course, than simply trying to respond to it in a very effective and, again, aggressive fashion. Anticipating these sorts of attacks, the unfortunate reality of at least this portion of the 21st century, and again, if more police units, and for that matter, healthcare officials and others within urban environments are thinking about these sort of, you know, urban warfare being foisted upon cities, then it's possible that a new operational art, as it were, can be adopted by, and these sorts of attacks may not be nearly as difficult to deal with in the future.
So if people were interested in more about this, where it might go, do you have any recommendations for them?
Sure, I'm terrible with titles, but names I can do. The individuals who began studying the tactical package very early, one of them is Adam Dolnick. He used to be at RUSI in London. I believe he's moved on from there since then. He wrote a monograph that's very in research where this is concerned. Sumantra Bose as well, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his Indian name appropriately, but he wrote about the first Fidian attacks that were during the Kargil War between 1999 and 2001, thereabout. Those are definitely two individuals that you would need to read for a context. However, there are a lot of writers, among them David McKillen, I believe he's Australian, Sullivan and Elkus Berth, Adam Elkus, John Sullivan, who's a former police official here in the States, who've both written specifically about this notion of an art, and then again David McCullum, who has also written about the notion of urges or urban warfare in the 21st century and how it is probably going to evolve in the favor of non-state actors as we move further and further into this this century. So those are some of the names.
And your paper is?
My paper, which I'm sorry to say has not yet been published. The paper that I wrote in 2001 was more of a broad exploration of this phenomenon as it evolved in South Asia between 1999 and 2011. I've written a working paper for the sake of hope is that this will turn into a project in the next year or so, whereby I'll be able to create a database that will allow for more of these analyses to, you know, be possible, particularly because the desire for indicators, just as you pointed out, is extreme one, to say the least.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Herbert Tinsley. And
sure.
Everyone else, have a good day.
Again, all links can be found in the show notes and on our website at www.njhomelandsecurity.gov. If you have any ideas or topics for future episodes, please contact us on Twitter at NJOHSP or email us at intelunclass@njohsp.gov. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe to Intelligence Unclassified.